Good evening. James McKinney here with my Science Hour for September 6th, 2018. And we're heading down the home stretch. Fall, Labor Day's over. Oh my goodness, another year flying by. But I'm going to start out with just a little... I just am amazed. I just sometimes have to fall off my chair and pick myself up when I read these stories. Space.com this week, this is the mouthpiece for disinformation science for the public, or people who think they're scientifically astute read this garbage. But remember, back in the 1950s, a guy named Emanuel Velikovsky wrote a book called World in Collision, in which he talked about Venus being a large comet coming through the solar system and meandering through the solar system, encountering Mars, and then somehow magically, of course they didn't know at the time, my work does explain how this all works, but the idea of meandering planets, that somehow they were not always in the orbit that they're in today, violated all rules of classical celestial mechanics, which is the study, mathematical study of the motion of the planets. So this week, space.com comes out with a story basically stating, and this is being done by young astronomers who, of course, have no clue about the old days, but the story comes out stating that now they think Mars used to be in by Venus. Therefore, that's why it could have had water and an atmosphere. And then slowly, they don't say how, worked its way out to where it is today. So now officialdom has its own, its very own, meandering planet theory. And so, of course, this is published in a peer review journal, but it couldn't be true for Velikovsky, but it could be true for young aspiring astronomers or astrophysicists, whatever they call themselves, to say pretty much the same thing. And, of course, they talk about, they mention the riverbeds, the visible marks of water erosion on Mars. That, of course, Mars doesn't have any ocean, doesn't have any water, doesn't have any rain, but it has these pristine riverbeds, and clearly it had water at one time. All the signs are there, but they never mention the fact that they claim that this happened billions of years ago, and of course, there's no rationale for stating that at all. I mean, they just pull these numbers out of the air. So how on earth did all of this happen? Well, they don't say. They ran a few computer simulations. That seems to be good enough for them. And it's like this one SpongeBob episode. Remember SpongeBob for kids? SpongeBob SquarePants. And anyway, the SpongeBob is beset with guarding a monster who's frozen in ice. And there's a lever there. If you pull a lever there, then it thaws the monster out. And so anyway, SpongeBob is not watching the monster. And the monster kind of starts to thaw enough where he can talk to SpongeBob. And he says, to pull a lever. And SpongeBob says, no, Mr. Krabby Patty or whoever told him, said, do not pull that lever no matter what. And so anyway, SpongeBob says, no, I'm not supposed to pull a lever. And so then the monster, who's frozen in the ice, takes on the nice attitude. And he goes, oh, please. And SpongeBob goes, well, look, mister, they told me you're really a terrible, mean monster, and I should never let you pull a lever so that you're thawed out and can escape. And the monster goes, oh, pretty please, I promise, I'll be good. And SpongeBob goes, oh, that's good enough for me. And he pulls the lever. The monster escapes and destroys everything. So anyway, that is the peer review. The SpongeBob SquarePants peer review. Ah, that's good enough for me. And on it goes. And the monster escapes and destroys everything. but it's so absurd, and the contradictions and the just the blatant disrespect for the severe animosity that went out towards Velikovsky and myself, not to mention, you know, I got a thick skin, but decades of me talking about how the planets are formed from large comets and the tail drag, and I have an actual process by which the large comets change their orbits and nestle in to become a planet. I actually have a process that does this. And they're just like, oh, they ran some computer models, and although it's unlikely, the computer model shows Mars moving from where Venus is out to where Mars is today. Oh my goodness, just lollipops and roses. Just a quick commentary about last week, my subject. I talked about kind of a collage of topics related to history. And first of all, when nobody else talks about these types of subjects, that's when I step in. And I use my show time because it's you will not hear what I said last week on any other radio show. The putting together the pieces of the control of and especially related to science of the Catholic Church throughout history. Remember, the Muslim Church was a offshoot of the Catholic Church, and the all of the other sects that came out of Catholicism that became the many Christian denominations, you might say, that exist today. But all of this really getting away from the very simple points of Christianity. And remember, it was the Catholic Church that brought us the Flat Earth Society, the Flat Earth Theory in the Middle Ages. And oddly enough, there are people still running around talking about that today. Some people email me sometimes, but let me just mention regarding that, that you can measure as a person walking around on Earth, it's very easy to measure the radius, the circumference of the Earth. And all you need are simple tools that you can buy at the hardware store and a tall hill or mountain, not more than 600 feet. If you can get up to 600 feet or more above sea level, where you have a good view of a lake that you cannot see the other shore, then you can measure the circumference of the Earth very easily. And there's many other ways to do that. But the ancients, they were very cognizant of the fact that the Earth was round, and they had a very good estimate of the diameter of the Earth and circumference of the Earth. And Columbus did, the royalty did, but what they taught the peasants was that the Earth was flat. And that's the same type of teachings that occur today, all kinds of crazy science, you know, the Big Bang, about evolution, and on and on, that literally, after you peel back the first onion layer, make no sense at all. So, and I talk about that. I talk about it on my paid cast, which everybody should be joining. But the when I go off into topics like that, it's this week I'm going back. I'm going to be talking about this hexagonal pattern on Saturn and the scientific explanation for that. I've talked about this before, but now they've come to realize that the hexagonal pattern at the pole of Saturn is elevated from the Saturnian atmosphere, and so as much as 180 miles. So anyway, that's very interesting. But the question is, why is it a six-sided pattern? And there's a very good reason for this. If you understand my weather book, and by the way, that's what I'm talking about currently on my paid cast, is the weather book. But the idea of how does a six-sided storm form? What are the parameters? What makes it six-sided? Why not five? Why not seven? Why not three? Why not two? Why not 18? You know, why six? Why do you see that? And it turns out, interestingly enough, that Earth has the same pattern. Earth has the same pattern at its, especially the South Pole, and I'll be showing some indications of this, how you can look at it. But the wind patterns at the South Pole of Earth right now have a six-sided hexagonal shape also. And so what I'll be doing in this show is explaining in detail. I'll take you through the rudimentary steps of the basic theory and then building it up to the point where you're going to understand after this show how the six-sided hexagonal weather system at the pole of Saturn, why that exists and what's causing it. So at any rate, let me just start with something. Take seven coins. Could be pennies, nickels, not all of the same denomination, all of the same, like all seven pennies. Don't take two quarters and one nickel and three pennies. Take all six of quarters, all six of half dollars, pennies, whatever. Okay, seven of them. And lay them in a pattern on the table so that you have one in the center and then put the other ones around. And what you're going to find is you have a six hexagonal pattern, a six-sided pattern, or six-pointed pattern, whichever you choose. But six, because six circles of a certain diameter wrap perfectly around a circle of the similar diameter. So, what does that have to do with the storms at Saturn? Well, it's very simple. There are storms that build up, and they're of a certain energy level at a certain size. And so it only makes sense that they would configure themselves in a six-sided pattern. Because, okay, so let me go back and talk about cyclonic storms in general. Back in the mid-1990s, I was working with Russian scientists, and they had observed, they had observed tornadoes racing across the surface of the sun, but they stuck out from the sun. So this is key number one when we come back to Saturn, talking about these storm systems that have just been measured to be extended out from the surface, the upper atmospheric surface of Saturn. Because remember that Saturn is not a planet like Earth where we can see the core. There's a core in there, but we cannot see it, and all we really see is the atmosphere. So the storms have now been measured, this six-sided hexagonal storm system, and I'll be putting a picture, by the way, on the webpage also, hopefully by the time this show airs, that shows this hexagonal pattern at the pole of Saturn. And right in the middle, right at the pole, is a big hurricane system that just sits there and spins. And so if you take six storms of that size and you put them around the center storm, you get the six-sided figure. And so you might say, well, why is it five? Why wouldn't it be five, or why not seven, etc.? And the reason is because the energy coming in that drives those storms, the electrical energy, is fueling storms of the same energy level, in other words, the same size. So you basically have six hurricanes going in a pattern, and they're of the same size, the same energy level, and therefore they form a hexagonal pattern, just like the seven coins, the one in the middle and the six coins around give you the hexagonal pattern. But let's go back to the tornadoes on the sun. The tornadoes on the sun, now, what the reason the Russians loved my work was because I explained the process. Now, the electrical currents that are near the surface of the sun, just like on Earth, the negative part in the coronal region of the sun is negatively charged electrons, relativistic electrons. And so you have a capacitor with the visible surface of the sun positively charged. And so what happens is when there's a discharge between the corona, the electron part, which is just like a superatom, it's the exact same situation as an atom, where you have the inner nucleus is positively charged, and then the outer, the electrons are going around, and they are basically, that's the structure of an atom. So the sun, in a sense, is a superatom. But when a discharge occurs, the electrons form the majority of the charge carriers, but what they do is they ionize the gases that are near the surface of the sun, and they come up the column. That's the visible part. You can't see the electrons. They're there too. They're providing the majority of the electrical current sheet in that tornado, and just exactly like on Earth. If you look at a tornado on Earth, it's the exact same process. And so the ions then start to move up the column, the electrical discharge column, and as they do, they start to rotate. And it's the same process when you pull the plug in the bathtub, the vortex motion of the water going down the drain, the Coriolis force, it's the same process on the sun. But the gases, ionized gases, are moving up, not down the drain, they're moving up. So they spin in a predictable direction. So that is the cause of tornadoes on the sun. And it's explained perfectly by my theoretical work. The Russians loved this because they were really dumbfounded. They had no explanation of why there would be tornadoes on the sun. There are other storm activities on the sun. For example, sunspots are a little bit chaotic, but it's the same thing, where the sunspot is a cooler region and on the sun's surface, and it's a region of low pressure. But let's to get a better idea of this kind of activity, you go to Jupiter's Great Red Spot. And also in my earliest work, I identified Jupiter and Saturn both as small stars with fusion ongoing in their atmosphere, etc. And so they set up their own capacitor, etc. But the Great Red Spot on Jupiter is a tornado, is a hurricane. You could call it a cyclonic storm. You could even call it the top of a tornado. But it's a cyclonic storm. I'd say hurricane is a much better analogy. And there are hundreds of similar hurricane atmospheric structures on Jupiter, much smaller. The Great Red Spot is the largest one, the most visible. It was visible to Galileo back in the Middle Ages. And so Galileo could see the Great Red Spot. And of course, ever since, it's been moving around the planet Jupiter. Okay, so what's with the Great Red Spot? It's a hurricane. It's driven by atmospheric electricity, the current sheet, the same process that I just described relative to the tornadoes on the sun is what drives the hurricanes in the atmosphere of Jupiter. And when we have hurricanes on planet Earth, when the hurricanes are out over the ocean, the ocean is not a good ground. But what happens is the current sheet, the electrons coming down, ionize the gases at the surface of the ocean. And as they come up the column, they also spin. And that's what causes the vortex motion in the hurricane, being powered by electrical currents from the ionosphere. It has nothing to do with warm water. I've given examples continually that Mars has hurricanes, but has no water of any kind. Earth has hurricanes that are up by Alaska. The biggest hurricane in Earth's history, in recorded history, was the Perfect Storm out in the North Atlantic in the month of November. So which was a combination of three hurricanes. So hurricanes are not related to warm water. That is just absolute absurdity. So but it's the electrical current sheet that actually is powering these storms. Okay, so now Earth, if you would look above a thunderstorm, if you would look above a hurricane, you're going to find sprites and elves. These are electrical discharge phenomena that reside above clouds, cloud systems. And these might be 100,000 feet, 150,000 feet up into the air, which is like, between 50, 100,000 feet is around 20 miles up. 150,000 feet is around 30 miles up. Very thin atmosphere up there. You're way above the atmosphere in which airplanes could fly, or jet airplanes. Jet airplanes can go up to 40,000 feet, in some cases 50,000 feet, but that's about their upper limit for air-breathing, atmosphere-breathing jet engine. So this is way up there where the atmosphere is very thin, but you can see this electrical activity that is a result of the discharge between the ionosphere and down at the ocean level, and that's the cause of the hurricanes. Okay, so when the hurricane comes and approaches a shoreline, what happens? Well, the shoreline is a good ground, and the hurricane begins to short out electrically. It's no longer creating the ions that would come up that are prevalent at the surface of the ocean. So it starts to short out electrically, and that's why a lot of times when a hurricane comes in and makes landfall, there are many tornadoes, and people think it's the hurricane that's creating all the wind and damage, when it's not. It's the tornadoes. The tornadoes are the cause a lot of times of the severe damage, and these could be very high velocity tornadoes as a result of the storm discharging off the leading edge as it approaches landfall. And so then also, because the storm is losing its energy, it starts to dump the water. And by the way, this was my plan back in the 90s to steer hurricanes offshore with the laser satellites and then short them out artificially using buoys and cables and weather balloons that are on cables to short the storm out offshore so it would cause much less damage. But of course, none of this ever got done because the ridiculous National Weather Service, the Hurricane Prediction Center, these people are complete idiots. They don't know what causes hurricanes. They don't know anything about it. They keep government jobs. And just like NASA prevents us from really going into space, the National Weather Service really prevents us from stopping the damaging effects of hurricanes. And remember the old myth. This is another little interesting story. Remember the old myth that trailer courts were like a magnet for tornadoes. And if you understand that those metal aluminum boxes all lined up in rows sitting out there in a field are sticking up above the ground, are like a lightning rod. And so what does it do? It just draws that tornado right into them. So that's scientifically explained with my theoretical work that trailer courts are like a lightning rod for tornadoes. And in the case of about a decade ago, we had a lot of hurricanes coming into Florida. And those tornado systems associated with the hurricanes went straight for the trailer courts, of which there are many in Florida, and completely destroyed entire trailer court areas. So the science is understanding how these things work. Okay, so this is a little bit of background. And now my point is that I was talking about sprites and elves and electrical systems above the tornadoes and above the hurricanes. If you were to go up to the upper atmosphere and go out into outer space, there are literally electrical connections, and I have drawings of these types of connections in my weather book, but they would look like a leech, if you've ever seen a picture of a leech attached to the side of a fish. Well, a leech is a bloodsucker. It attaches to the side of the fish starts to drain the blood out, lives off the blood of the fish. But it has a characteristic shape that comes out from the side of the fish. That's the closest explanation that I can give of what these electrical connections look like in outer space. And they're connected. They're bringing in water. They're bringing in hydrogen and oxygen, which are forming water. And you can actually measure the water coming into the surface of the Earth's atmosphere from outer space. And very much related to the low pressure cells that are down in the troposphere. So once again, you're not going to hear this on the evening news. And I think it's rather odd that this should all be peer-reviewed, published scientific papers, but none of it is. None of this would get published in a peer-reviewed scientific paper because they're off in la-la land trying to tell you that hurricanes are made from warm water. Just a totally ludicrous idea because for many, many reasons, but there's not enough energy in that little bit of heat that occurs when a hurricane passes over the water. What's really going on there is that little bit of heat loss is due to evaporation of the water off of the surface of the water. That, when water evaporates, it has a cooling effect. And so that's why it appears that the water cools after a hurricane has passed. But we've seen many times where a bigger hurricane follows in the path of a smaller hurricane. And if the warm water theory were correct, then the bigger hurricane should be first and the smaller hurricane should be second, because the big hurricane supposedly has drawn all the energy out of the water already. So how come we have the opposite situation where the smaller hurricane is first and the bigger hurricane comes second? That's counterintuitive if you believe the warm water idea about the cause of hurricanes. Okay, so anyway, this gives you a little bit of structure on the form of these storms, the extent of them, the part that you don't see that extends up to the ionosphere and then out into outer space. Okay, and this would be true of let me just go back to Jupiter. I was talking about the Great Red Spot. The reason the Great Red Spot has been going on for hundreds of years, going round and round, the reason the Great Red Spot is not extinguished is because there's no land underneath to short out. It keeps going and going and going. It's like the Ever-Ready Bunny. You know, the little commercial where the bunny keeps going and going. Well, that's like the Great Red Spot. And it's not due to some kind of battery. It, in a sense it is, yeah, but not a little flashlight battery. It's due to the electrical battery in the fusion system of Jupiter. The fusion system causing non-uniform current of protons, which causes the capacitor. The discharge of that capacitor is what fuels the energy in the red spot on Jupiter. Okay, so we're trying to relate these. But the reason, once again, that the Great Red Spot of Jupiter is not extinguished, that it doesn't diminish, is because there's no land mass underneath to short it out. So it just keeps going and going and going. Around and around and around, and has been for 300 years. And now, because of spacecraft, you can see the Great Red Spot actually interacting with other spots and basically chomping them up. It's just like another tropical storm comes by it, and it just assimilates that littler storm into the Great Red Spot. Anyway, that is a little bit of information on how these storm systems work. The next step we're going to do, let's go to the South Pole of Earth. The South Pole of Earth. Now, why does Earth, or why does the South Pole, or South Pole of Saturn, likewise, why does that have an electrical current attachment? Well, the answer is that there's Saturn and Jupiter and Earth and Mars and Venus, all of the planets, Mercury, they all are acting like comets. They're discharging the solar capacitor. So they're part of an electrical circuit. That electrical current is what's driving these storms at the, for example, the South Pole of Earth. Earth, and these change, and anybody that studies this, for example, hexagonal pattern on Saturn, will tell you that they change. They're seasonal. They change with the season. It depends on where Saturn is around the sun. And so it's a seasonal storm pattern that is accentuated by its position around the sun. And of course, that depends on many factors. But basically, because of the discharge of the solar capacitor, these storm systems have constant influx of energy in the form of electrical currents. So once they set up, now remember I said take 7 coins, put one on a table, similar coins, pennies or whatever, put one on the table and put 6 around, and the pattern that forms is a hexagon. Okay, so next I want you to go to a web page. The web page is called earth.nullschool.net. I'll spell that out. It's Earth, like E-A-R-T-H, Earth, dot, period, Null School, NULLSCHOOL.net. So earth.nullschool.net. Just go to that webpage and scroll. You can put your mouse cursor on any point on the Earth and drag the Earth around. Now, the point is to go to the South Pole. And so we go, hopefully, you know enough geography on how to maneuver this thing to get to the South Pole. I can't tutor you on that on the air. But just play around with it. And then when you get to the South Pole, you'll see the continent of Antarctica. And so just have that pointing directly at you. And sit there and watch the wind patterns. And eventually, if you watch this long enough, it might not happen today, just return to this web page occasionally, and you will occasionally see these 6 weather patterns form around the central weather pattern. I was just looking yesterday, and it was not doing it, because the Earth is a little bit different. It's a little more active, etc. But if you look long enough, you will see the 6-sided storm form with the central storm, and they're all about the same size. And a lot of times you'll see 2 or 3 storms forming out there. And now what's happened at Saturn is that this pattern has established itself, and just like the great storm, once it gets going, then it's going to stay there. Now, I've watched this earth.nullschool.net page. I've observed the South Pole region to carry for days and days and days sometimes the 6-sided storm pattern, with the 1 in the middle and the 6 equally dimensioned, equal size storms around. And I've watched it for days where it'll sustain those patterns, and then they'll break up, they'll go away, etc. And but it's the same situation. And so that's what's causing the pattern at Saturn, and it's above the atmosphere. So let me go back to the tornadoes on the sun. Remember that the tornadoes on the sun are above the solar atmosphere. They race around the surface of the sun, and they stick out from the sun. So this is an electrical phenomenon. It's explained by the fact that the discharges between the surface, the upper surface of the sun, what we see is, and by the way, don't look at the sun with your eyes or optical equipment. You can only look at the sun through specially designed equipment, just to make sure that nobody thinks you should be looking at the sun. Do not look at the sun with your eyes, and certainly not with binoculars or through glasses. Only look at the sun with specially designed equipment. And if you're in doubt about that, go to a specialist who would steer you in the right direction. But you don't have to look at the sun yourself. You can see these. I'll have a picture posted on my webpage. And what's interesting is around, I think it was around 2011, finally NASA saw these with their one of their sun-watching spacecraft and reported it as a great discovery. Well, I got news for them. The Russians had seen these well over a decade earlier and reported it, and we had the full explanation for why they were there, what caused them. So, but don't tell that to anybody at NASA. Let them continue to sleep in their ivory tower or whatever they pay for them to sleep in over there. But the tornadoes on the sun, okay, so that's another issue. And by the way, the closest thing we have to Earth to tornadoes on the sun are called waterspouts. And so that's another thing that I'll be putting some photos on my webpage of all of these with some commentary, etc., the pictures of the day. And hopefully I'll have all of this posted by the time this show airs so you can go and check those out. And, you know, just a quick aside note, I've been very busy in the background all these last weeks and months and years, actually, with some projects going on in the background. So that's, unfortunately, my webpage has not been upgraded the way it should have been. But there's something else going on. I will have a brand new, spanking new, shiny, spiffy webpage very shortly. And so that I'm very excited about. It'll be modern and all of those things. And it'll make it easier for me to post pictures and things like that. So it's been a long time in coming. But remember that I do all of this myself. And therefore, it's a little bit taxing to try and keep up with everything else that I happen to be doing. But the closest thing to the tornadoes on the sun on planet Earth are waterspouts, because the waterspouts, I have seen these personally, and of course, I'll post some pictures of these on my webpage, but you look out over the ocean and all of a sudden there's a waterspout, and they're actually pretty dangerous. We've heard stories of fishermen or people out on a boat, and all of a sudden it starts to rain, and it's raining fish. Like fish are flying in out of the sky, and that's, believe me, it's not a fun experience. If you get hit by a flying fish, I mean, coming down out of the sky, not, you know, flying fish, that's dangerous too, where they jump out of the water, they can actually hit people on a boat. But I'm talking raining fish. And this is the result of a water spout, where they actually, if the fish are at the surface, they suck the fish up and they go flying up in the air, and then they go, you know, they come, if some person is unfortunate enough to be in the area where they're coming down, it's a problem, very dangerous. But anyway, the water spout is the same situation. And standard meteorology has absolutely no explanation for tornadoes on the sun or water spouts or for any of these cyclonic types of storms. In reality, this stupid idea that hurricanes are formed by warm water is absurd. But anyway, the water spouts, it's an electrical current that occurs, and this can happen on a perfectly blue, sunshiny day, just as tornadoes have happened on a perfectly blue, sunshiny day. As the people in Siren, Wisconsin, which is not there anymore. Siren, Wisconsin was completely wiped off the map by an F5 tornado on a perfectly clear blue sky day. In fact, the weather people didn't even pick it up. They weren't even thinking about this. It completely surprised. There were no warnings. There were no sirens. There were no alarms set off. There were no National Service Weather Service warnings given out, because they never expected an F5. This is a tornado that's like a mile wide at its base, and it formed over northern Minnesota and came into Wisconsin, Siren, Wisconsin, and devastated this poor little community that was totally just not expecting this on a clear blue sky day. And so these can happen. It's a very unusual situation where you have an electrical discharge, but a lot of times these are related to activity that's actually up in outer space above that location, and causes, like, the same thing happens up at the surface of the upper atmosphere above the ionosphere. When these space-related storm systems connect, they start to spin the atmosphere, and they can drive that all the way down to the surface of the Earth with the electrical currents coming all the way down to the surface of the Earth, and that's where you get the water spouts. In fact, water spouts are very common on the leading edge of a hurricane, another place where you commonly see water spouts, because they spin off and they spin free, but they're still connected electrically to the ionosphere, and they're spinning out across the ocean on a clear sunny day. And I have seen these. It's pretty strange. From miles and miles away, you see this water spout miles and miles high, like a tornado, like swirling back and forth, moving along on the surface of the ocean. And that's the closest thing we have on planet Earth to what we call tornadoes on the sun. Okay, so all of these are related. And the reason the water spout is similar to the tornado on the sun is because they're up above the surface. They're a single entity. They're not related to a big storm system. They're just a single entity, and they're above the surface of the sun, or in the case of the water spout, above the surface of the ocean. But the cause, the cause of the phenomenon is the same, the vertical electric field discharging. And we have seen these, for example, if you look on the cover of my book, Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection, you will see a picture of two comets passing by the sun. The second one flies right through an already existing solar discharge. And whoom, that extension, the discharge of the solar capacitor by the comet connects perfectly with that flare, and it explodes. One of the biggest solar flare explosion CMEs that ever was recorded coming off the sun was the response of that comet coming in front of that already existing solar discharge. But what's interesting is when that came out, it twisted up like a tornado. It corkscrewed up, so to speak, and just like a tornado would, or a water spout. And that's because of the same situation that the Coriolis force and the rising material is coming off the sun, the ions that are the visible part. You cannot see the electrons, which are coming in the discharge from the other direction. But basically, this is a response to the comet coming off of the surface of the sun, or connecting with that discharge that's already existing in that location. So, okay, now that you have a feel that all of these phenomena, that a cyclone, that a tornado, a waterspout, a hurricane, the six-sided pattern on Saturn, the great red spot, there's also many spots on Saturn that are similar to the great red spot, but all of these are similar. All of these are very similar, and they're all due to the same phenomenon, and some of them extend up into outer space. The connection goes up into outer space. And I'll bring in one other related phenomenon here, which is the jet streams. Now, this is all described in my weather book also. Around the equator of Earth, we find the westerly moving equatorial current sheet, which is primarily electrons. In the northern hemisphere and the southern hemisphere, the easterly moving ionospheric current sheets are moving in the easterly direction, and they are like snaking patterns. And the reason those snake up and down, north and south, is because they're wrapping around low and high pressure cells. The low pressure cells, the the low pressure cells spin in a counterclockwise direction because they're rising up. The currents are being drawn up, and that's what causes the low pressure cell. So the wind wraps around the bottom side of those, and then when the wind goes north, eventually it connects and wraps around a high pressure cell, and that's rotating in the opposite direction. So that's the reason the jet streams do this snaking pattern around the northern and the southern hemisphere. And then we have two other current belts that are rotating in the westerly direction. These are the electron current sheets, and this is the typical cause of the auroras, because the protons coming in from the solar wind come down to interact with the electrons, and that's what creates the auroras, which we continually see. You can see the auroras if you go to the SOHO webpage, the NASA the Solar Observatory webpage, they have one of the buttons you can click on, and you can see the donut shape of the auroras at the north and south poles continually. And there's other websites also where you can watch this phenomenon. There's also cross electrical currents that cross over the pole. Okay, now I spoke earlier and said that this should be in a peer-reviewed journal, and typically in a real world of science, it would be. And the peer review would allow the author to maintain control of their work. But in the real world of today in science, when an author publishes their work, it all of a sudden becomes the work of the journal, the copyrights, etc. And, of course, most of these Yahoo scientists, government-controlled scientists, are working on government grants because they've forgotten how to go out and find money. Like, I fund my own research, and you help me out by buying my water filters or my books on my webpage. So thank you very much, people that are cognizant of that. So I fund my own research, and I publish my own work. I pay for my own radio show. I don't have sponsors. This is a commercial-free show. And so in a real world, there would be, when an author published their material, it would be still owned by the author. And in a real world, the author would also have funding, and there would be private ownership of the science. But the way it is today, all of this garbage science is owned by the government, and then it's any real science is tier one science, and you will never see that. So anyway, what I want to do right now is flesh out what I've just told you. Now, I've told you in words that you can imagine in your mind how this works, because everybody knows what a tornado or hurricane looks like, etc. And if not, go to my webpage. I'll have pictures posted. But now I'm going to go into some of the details that I would put in a published paper on this particular topic that would include formulas and numbers and quantities and parameters, etc. So let's take a look, for example, at a hurricane. That's a very good example. So let's start in Central Africa during the rainy season, which would amount to from about June to November. So the rainy season in Central Africa is where the storms come across the Central Plains, and that is where they hook up with the ionosphere. That's where the first electrical connections with those cumulonimbus clouds are connecting to the ionosphere electrically, and this is a pass through down to the through the clouds to ground, and that's where the observable electrical currents are, the lightning bolts. But as this rolls off the western tip of Africa, as the trade winds, you might say, that are moving in a westerly direction, as these move off the west coast of Africa, now they're over the ocean, and there's no ground there. There's nothing for the electrical current to connect to and complete a circuit. And so there's only the ocean, the surface of the ocean. So what happens? The electrical currents that were shorting to ground earlier are now ionizing the air at the surface of the ocean. And those ions are going to follow the current path, so they start to come up. And you can watch the very tallest cumulonimbus clouds, 100, 120,000 feet up in the air, much higher than an airplane can fly. And they're all of a sudden, you can see these on satellite photos, you can see the eye of the hurricane start to form. And that's because the currents are coming up in that location where the very tallest cloud is. And then what happens is that current sheet starts to spin, and that's where the hurricane begins to form. So let's talk about physical parameters here, the current sheets. And these are over maybe a 20 or 30 square mile region. And then what happens as the vortex forms, the entire cloud system begins to spin, and that creates wind down at the surface of the ocean. And as that wind blows across the ocean evaporates and it slightly cools the ocean. And that's what's mistaken by standard science, by they believing that somehow that evaporation is the cause of the hurricane. How absolutely ludicrous. And I always use the example, the following. If somebody saw an automobile driving down the road, and that's the first time they ever saw a car, and you ask them, what makes the car go down the road? And they look at it from a distance, and they go, well, there's some smoke coming out the tailpipe. That must be what's pushing the car down the road. Not understanding that there's a giant gasoline or diesel engine in this automobile. But if you were to go up to the car and measure the amount of gases coming out the exhaust pipe, you would say, "Woo, this is not enough energy to push the car down the road. Something else must be going on." And that's the same case with hurricanes. If you look at the amount of energy loss due to the cooling of the water when the hurricane passes, it's equivalent to the energy coming out the tailpipe of the car. It's not enough to create a hurricane, let alone cause all the winds. And also the third law of thermodynamics state that organized systems tend to move into less organized systems, not the other way around. So the idea that somehow warm water organizes into this vortex and creates a hurricane violates the second and third laws of thermodynamics. Just is the way it is. So these people are just completely out to lunch. But the current sheets that we're talking about here have a set of value. There's a certain amount of current, and there's the electron current that's coming down from the ionosphere. But none of this is ever measured because the morons in standard science that are wasting all of our science money at NASA, the National Atmospheric and Oceanic Administration, the Hurricane Prediction Center, they're out there imagining it's the warm water. So the real cause of the hurricane is never measured, the electrical currents. And in situations like this, we have to rely on measurements. So the unfortunate issue is today, unfortunately, I don't have enough money or resources to go out and make these measurements. It's a similar situation with comets. Now, interestingly enough, on the nose side of the comet, I've often talked about the spiral that occurs on very large comets, and you can see a picture on the cover of my book, Planet X Comets and Earth Changes, of the spiral nose current coming off the tip, the sunward tip of a comet. So it's acting much like a tornado. You know how a tornado kind of gives you that swirly look? Well, that's because it's interacting with a magnetic field. That's the same situation in comets. So do you understand how all of these phenomena are related if you know what to look for, if you know what's going on? And, of course, that's what's instrumental in understanding all of this is my work that brings all of this into a single, basically simple set of consistent facts, not a hodgepodge that a comet is different than a tornado, is different than a, you know... that's why you get, if you study science today, you get a hodgepodge. If you go to a standard university or whatever, you don't get science. You get a hodgepodge of unrelated facts. You memorize those. You spit them back in the test, and they call that science. It's just all garbage. But to put numbers and parameters on these would take measurements. But we can see, for example, the what are called sprites and elves, which are electrical current phenomenon above the cloud. And there again, imagine that a cloud is, what they say in standard science, that a cloud is like a battery due to tumultuous updrafts that creates a charge like a battery, and that's where lightning comes from. Well, how does this happen that lightning comes out the top of the cloud and the bottom of the cloud? I mean, it doesn't make any sense. And so the cloud is just an intermediary in the electrical circuit connecting the ionosphere to the ground or to the surface above the ocean if it's out over the ocean. The cloud is just an intermediary. It's like the bug in the backyard bug killer. When the bug flies in between the screens, it facilitates the discharge because it's enough. Like it'd be like sticking your finger in and or a wire, and that carries the ground potential in far enough to where the discharge occurs. The discharge always occurs where the bug is. The discharge always occurs where the clouds are. So very simple, very basic physics, and just by understanding the energy level in the hurricanes, one could calculate, make a rough estimate of the amount of energy involved in the electrical discharge, because that's the power source. So when you see the energy involved in a hurricane, calculate the wind energy, the momentum in the water, the rotation, the velocity, which would give you also the energy, the kinetic energy in the storm. And that would tell you, for example, the amount of energy that had to come from the electrical discharge. And it's not a 100% efficient process, but it could give you some good data on what to expect the electrical current sheet should be. So that'd be a good problem. If I had 10 grad students, that's what they would be doing. They would be doing this kind of work. And so anyway, it looks like I'm about out of time here. But remember, my water filters are on sale. The whole house filters are still on sale there. People have been buying those. It's a great way to get all of the chloramines and the glyphosates and everything out of your water. Because believe me, bad water in city systems and even out in the country. A lot of people live out in the country and have bad water. If you're near cornfields or grain fields or whatever, there's a lot of glyphosate in that water. You got to get that out of your water. There's a lot of cancer-causing chemicals in the water all over the United States. And my filters take all of that out in one filter. You don't need add-on filters, including arsenic, fluoride, glyphosate, all of that. And it's the only filter that really does work without any add-on filters. So go to my webpage, jmccsci.com. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.